My name is Misty and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual, in our own personal stories, describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair, cross-cut section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too, and I must have this thing. So I always get excited to introduce the best-dressed man in the room. And all the way from Easy 123 Group is George M.
All right, good evening, everybody. My name is George M., and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, George.
I'd like to thank Lisa for inviting me and Misty for introducing me today. The last time I told my story was up in North Georgia, and they gave me 15 minutes to tell my story. My sobriety date is 12/15 of 2006. I guess I'm coming up on something like 17 years of sobriety. I'm not a one white chip wonder, as they say. I've had other periods of sobriety. At one point, I had 14 years, and that was the first 14. Then I turned 15. I've had a couple other periods of sobriety since this time. So, one of the first sponsors I had, I'd like to kind of start off by saying, yeah, I'm an alcoholic, and I could also say I'm this, and I'm also this, and I'm also that. So, I have a sponsor that when I first came into CA, which is another one of the programs, and that doesn't stand for Coca-Cola. It's I think people know what that is, but I had a great sponsor, and he was from Akron, Ohio, actually, where Bill Wilson was from. Knew the Booker well. But what he suggested to me was that, he said, you know, it's just a lot easier just being an alcoholic. You know, if I'm this and I'm that, you know, I know a lot of us, and I can speak for myself, tend to complicate things. And it's easy to do or feel like, you know, it's unique. But if I'm too many different things, this is for me. Everybody's welcome to call themselves whatever they like, obviously. But, you know, for me, if it gets too many things, it can be, yeah, but this doesn't apply. Maybe that doesn't apply. So I found from my experience just, you know, just being an alcoholic is a lot easier. You know, at that point, I can get it. You know, what they talk about in the book. You know, as an alcoholic. And, of course, this works for a lot of different things. So, also, I believe I earned a seat in Al-Anon. I do occasionally go there and went there for some years. Seemed like I have a proclivity to rescue people, particularly damsels in distress. I'm somewhat colorblind when it comes to the relationships I've had, where most people see red flags, I see a green light. You know, so and I've gotten in some situations. Most of the time, the long-term relationships I've had have been just like the date that never ended. If you even wanted to call it a date. So, I am a musician by trade. I do work around alcohol. I don't like to necessarily brag about that. I have a friend of mine would say, don't get cocky with sobriety. And to me that, I know from bitter experience, it's, you know, it could be easy to do that. It's like, well, you know, I work around this, I've been sober for a while, yada, yada, yada. Next thing you know, Jed's a millionaire, but you're drunk again. So, But I do work around alcohol. I do feel like I need to be vigilant. And it's really not that difficult, I don't believe. I mean, I'm there to do something. I mean, it talks in our book, you know, we can go anywhere a free man could go. And, you know, by the grace of God and the program of AA, I'm able to do what I've done for many, many years and can continue to do that. So, so a little background. They talk about in generally what we used to, what our life was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I'll try to do that best I can. So I was born in Fort Worth, Texas. My father just had graduated from Georgia Tech. Now, he was a top honors graduate in aeronautics at Georgia Tech, top 5% in his class. The man never had a drop of alcohol in his life, and had the worst temper of anybody I've ever experienced. Just a horrid temper. And so, and my mom was just the absolute opposite. My story was I was raised by Hitler and Mother Teresa. That's kind of how that went. My dad was a good-hearted guy, but he was brought up in the streets of New Jersey, you know, back in the 30s, and I imagine that was a pretty rough area and stuff. And you know, I've come to believe, because of what's happened in my situation and what I've heard in other places, that alcoholism is a family illness. Because for me, I feel like, some people could argue with this, I guess, but that I was brought up in an alcoholic home with no alcohol in it. So my father, what my mother and father did have in common was both of their parents were alcoholics. My mother would talk about, she was from Alabama, and once again, my dad from New Jersey, just complete culture shock. They met here in Atlanta when my dad was going to Georgia Tech. But again, my mother would talk about her father would embarrass them because he was a town drunk. They'd go downtown to the place they lived in Anniston, Alabama, and see their father fall down drunk. My dad somewhat denied that his father was a drunk, but my mother said he had a drinking problem, as did all my father's brothers. So, you know, it's kind of strange. Like I say, I didn't really grow up around that in my home, although my father had his brother come down to work with him, and his brother was alcoholic and smoked cigarettes. I remember as a kid, seeing him is like, how can people be addicted to anything? You know, it's like, how can they just not stop doing something? I had a very curious mind, I think, you know. One of those like to play with math, like to play with fire, just curiosity, you know. It's going to kill the cat most times. So, but it just didn't make sense to me. And so I think I had something in the back of my mind that wanted to find out what it was like to be addicted. And that sounds bizarre, but... so at any rate, I was born in Fort Worth. We were there for about a year. And it's strange because I found out some years ago, they call Fort Worth the Piano City, which is not what you'd expect of Fort Worth, Texas. Apparently Ben Clyburn, who was big in the classical world, was born there. So anyway, we're there for a year. We moved to Orlando. I'll try to make this quick. My father, I went to work for Martin Marietta in Florida. We were there for about 5 years. At that time, my brother was born a year after I was. He had a twin that died at birth. And it was kind of odd because my mother was, went through pregnancy, and that happened. They lost my brother's twin at birth. And then my aunt just happened to see a mole on her back. And, it turned out to be malignant melanoma. And you would think, you know, with the pregnancy, you're going through doctor's exams, well, the doctor would have picked up on it, but they didn't. So anyway, they ended up taking a section of her back out like a basketball. I mean, it was radical surgery. And at that time, a lot of people died from melanoma, and she survived it. She actually had cancer all through her life, and she somehow or another survived to about almost 80 years old. So, yeah, I thought I forgot that. Thank you. So I can imagine what my parents went through, you know, some of the traumas. Sometimes as a kid, you pick up on traumas that your parents go through that, from what I understand, and, you know, so that must have been really something to go. They were picking out places for us to go move because they really didn't think my mother was going to make it. So anyway, she did survive that. I was about five and she decided to take piano lessons. There was a lady who had retired from Juilliard who was giving her lessons. And for some reason, I just begged her for piano lessons. I just was such a passion for piano. And so she asked her teacher about that, and she said, well, he's a little too young. And she gave her some flashcards. She said, bring him back in a couple months when and if he learns these. So I learned them in a couple weeks. And so, I mean, to me, it's like I almost could just play piano. It just made sense to me. And so she was pretty enamored with my talents. And unfortunately, my dad decided to move to Georgia about a year later. And the teacher was pretty upset about that. And so we moved to Atlanta. I don't know if my dad went to work for Lockheed. I think he went to work for Lockheed. At any rate, he at some point decided to get out of aeronautics and go in the building, which was, in my mind, was a big mistake because the stress, the financial stress, all these things, his abusive side started to come out. He started to get very physically abusive. So, you know, by the end of my story, I'm hoping to convince you that my alcoholism is really my mom and dad's fault. So, I heard a guy say, you know, it was like an AA comedian. There's some comedian, if you look online, there's some guys that are almost comedian level, but he said he was blaming his parents for that alcoholism. He goes, do you know what kind of mad scientist it would take to make an alcoholic? It's just beyond their skill set, you know. So, but for a lot of years, I certainly blamed my dad. He was very physically abusive. Again, like I say, although a real good man, he provided, and, you know, he wasn't a drunk. But he sure acted like it. I mean, he'd break up furniture. We'd be afraid of what kind of mood he'd be in when he came home. It was like living with an alcoholic. And on to, like, my elementary school years were pretty tame. I think I was a pretty good student. Probably above. They did tests back then for intelligence tests, and they didn't tell the students, but they told the parents, you know. My mother, I think, said, you're above average. You know, and like we hear in AA, or you hear that most alcoholics are above average intelligence, and you'll never hear that in Al-Anon. So, but that does seem to be the case. But anyway, my grades 1 through 6, I think I was a pretty good student. Once I hit 7th grade, it was a different level. Back then, it was junior high, and all of a sudden, there was a lot of fighting going on. Integration had just started happening. They started busing people in from other parts of the town. I saw a teacher dragged down the hall by her hair. So it was kind of crazy, and I wasn't really getting in a lot of trouble then. I went on to 8th grade. It was the first year they had middle schools. And we tore that school to shreds. I don't know why. It just seemed the thing to do. Started acting up. I know the first day I was there, a friend of mine put an iron in the dryer in the home ec class and turned it on. Just, you know, so the behavior, just, you know, wanting to get in trouble, rebelling, all that stuff. At the end of 8th grade, a friend of mine had a party, and every freak you could think of was at that party. I mean, it was long hair. The first joint I smoked, I'm sorry, my story has a little bit, I'll try to keep it on alcohol, but first joint I smoked that had powdered THC in it. And so, you know, there was booze there, drugs, just everything was just bringing on, you know. I was out in Santa Barbara and I went to a meeting. There was a guy there I met who actually got busted for the largest drug bust in Southern California. He came up to me. I led the meeting when I was there. And he had a book and stuff. And his story was, he said, you know, his gateway drug was nicotine. And I'm pretty sure that's the way it was for me, too. That's kind of where it started for me, you know. You know, that addiction that I was so curious about. So, and end of eighth grade, man, we're partying. It's on. Ninth grade, I walked in the first day, man, going to the boys' bathroom. And it's, you know, dope being sold, people smoking. Latanzi, the big Italian vice principal, came in. Victor Bagnetto, who just sounds like a troublemaker, was smoking. And Latanzi had a clipboard in his hand, just smashed him in the face with it. And he said, "Your dad said if you act up to beat the hell out of you." So it was just a crazy time, you know. It's like there were just all kinds of drugs going around. I'm sure my parents had no idea. I started playing football, and then quit about 6 months later. I wanted to be in a band because I played keyboards and stuff. And so I put a band together, and we're rehearsing downstairs, quit having people coming over. And for some reason, my parents thought it was okay for us to drink at that age. Like, I guess they didn't see any harm in it. And I got into the first nightclub when I was 15 years old. The guys that played in the band I was with were a good 4 or 5 years older than me, some of them. So, and that's what I liked hanging out with. I didn't want to hang out with ninth graders. You know, I wanted to be up with the cool people, the older people, skip over that whole thing, you know. So I don't know how I graduated. I mean, high school, I think I got favor a lot of times just because I played, like in high school and stuff, or junior high, I'd win a talent show. And I remember one 7th grade teacher saying, "I'm glad to see you have some redeeming qualities." So, you know, that was, you know, finally did graduate high school. And, you know, at that point I was drinking alcoholically, but I didn't have what we talk about as a phenomenon of craving. If you're new here, our book talks about part of the illness of alcoholism is that we have a craving for it. Well, based on the amount that we were drinking, we'd drink on the weekends and put cases of beer away. And, you know, it was not really that big a deal. Mostly it was like we could brag about it Monday morning. Well, hey, we drank 3 cases this weekend. You know, so that went on and went on. I did graduate high school by the skin of my teeth. Just barely got out of high school. I stayed out of school for a year. I went on the road with a disco band from Philly and did that. And again, the drinking, you know, it's starting to escalate. We're partying. You know, we want to party like a rock star. And I decided that wasn't what I wanted to do. I went back to college. And this was the thing for me that started happening, is this dual kind of lifestyle. I mean, on one hand, I was a well-trained classical pianist, kind of, you know, respected for that kind of thing. On the other, I'm out here partying like a rock star, you know. And I'm hoping those two worlds wouldn't collide and people find out about that. And, you know, I'd get a reputation for it, you know, so... So I did all that, and, you know, I didn't graduate high school. I went to Georgia State for 5 years with a piano performance degree, and they had some complication. I was playing 5 nights a week, with a group called the Wits End Players here from Atlanta. And I couldn't go. They had concert attendance. They wanted you to attend other students' concerts and stuff. So I couldn't do that, and so I couldn't graduate. I had 180 hours. And that's where the F it started happening. You know what? F this. You know, I want to go do what I want to go do. And so I dropped out of school and went to work at a music store here in Atlanta, a place called Rhythm City. It was just a nut house. I mean, we're doing stuff during the day, back in the, you know, storage room, snorting this, drinking that, drinking until all hours of the night. You know, again, all this time things are escalating, but I'm still not really craving that I can remember. So that went on for a good while. I had a relationship I got into. There was somebody I met. When I first started to college at Georgia State, I was playing at Houston's. They'd opened the very first Houston's restaurant on North Side Drive, I think it was. And so I'm playing, and this guy comes up and lays his rail out on the piano while I'm playing. It's like, well, what is this? And it just turned into, he had a real nice, real good-looking girl with him, and he was a strange guy, but, and we ended up going back over to his house, place over at Powers Ferry. He had two big, huge grand pianos there. A lot of money. He had inherited a lot of money or something. But anyway, all that to say, there was a girl I met there. My name is George Martin, which is really the Beatles producer. And so this guy told, I'm going to use a different name, Alice, that I was George Martin's here, and she thought it was the Beatles producer. So she came over, and so, you know, once again, that was a date that never ended. And this one had a horrific cocaine problem. So we were together for 3 or 4 years. She'd be gone for a week at a time, just not know where she's at. She'd come back home, and I ended up taking her to GMHI. You know, it was a mess, you know, and those were the kind of relationship I got hooked into. You know, finally that, after about 4 years, she went to rehab, came back. The whole time I was drinking and carrying on myself, it's like I went to Al-Anon. I mean, really the first meeting I ever went to was Al-Anon. And I'm sitting there going, why am I here? This is not my problem. You know, this is her problem. And so, you know, I continue on with that. That relationship fell apart, like, of course, a lot of drug addicted ones do and stuff. And so, a couple of years after, I get emotional when I tell this, but a couple of years after we broke up, I remember coming home. My addiction had kind of started to take off. I moved into drinking liquor in my 30s. Before that, it was beer, maybe a shot or something, but I started really putting it in high gear with the drinking and drugging once we broke up. And so I come home that night, and I remember I was so messed up. I fell on my knees. I'm going, God, please give me something, you know, to help me stop doing what I'm doing, you know. And so it was strange. The next day, my mother called and said she had seen in the paper that Alice had hit and killed two people. Sorry, just a second. So she had, I get more upset with the people she killed than for her, but she had just run up cocaine and got in the car, and it was raining real bad that night. I remember the night it was raining real bad. She hit a truck. The vehicle off that truck and hit this car, and it killed the driver. And his wife, who was a Marietta police officer, that had just come home from church. And they had an 18-month-old baby in the back seat to live through. Just a horrible, horrible thing. I saw her on TV that night. And you know, thinking about it, was that it didn't stop me from drinking. I just continued to drink after that. As horrible as that was, they sentenced her to 35 years in jail. The parents of the family, of the couple that killed, said, we're going to be at every hearing you got to make sure you don't get out. And I, you know, I don't know, like I say, for whatever reason, that just didn't stop my drinking. So I you know, I just essentially continued with that. I got to the point, I think, where I tried to get out of the music business and try to do a day job. I got a job, believe it or not, for a 1-900 number company, if anybody remembers those things. I was an audio engineer for that 1-900 number company. It's like, oh my God. I was making about 50 grand a year at that time, which was a lot back in whatever, early 90s, I guess. And I was still, you know, drugging and drinking. I couldn't get two nickels to rub together. Living at home with my parents, even making pretty good money, you know, and stuff. And so that went on for about a year and a half. I finally got out of that thing and then started working some other jobs. And, you know, I mean, it just got to the point where I was unemployable. I know I'm leaving some things out here. Before all that, I had, you know, I've had some great accomplishments in the music business. I was, I ended up being the touring keyboardist for Peebo Bryson back, I'm trying to think when that was, maybe the mid to late 80s. And I did that for several years, recorded several albums with them. So I had some real high points in my career, but I'm pretty sure alcohol kind of sucked away a lot of that stuff, you know. I was at a place with a plane in California with Peebo. I walked downstairs right afterward and walked right into Miles Davis and Cicely Tyson. And Peebo introduced me, and Miles shook my hand, so he enjoyed my playing, which is a pretty rare compliment, you know. So, you know, along these things, like I say, with the music business, the highs and lows, I played for the Prince of Brunei, the richest man in the world, during the 96 Olympics. I was asked to play for them twice. And then, you know, like I said, but all along, and actually I was sober at that time. I had about a year and a half sober in CA. And I remember because I was asked to play for them. They were staying at a place in Marietta, the Prince and Princess of Brunei. And I was worried they'd want to have a toast with me. I was sober at that time. And so it turned out that drinking was against their religion. So, you know, a lot of these worries that we have during sobriety, this is going to happen. You know, so I've had a lot of great things happen in the music business, but I got to the point where I was just unemployable. You know, I had to get out of the music business. I started working music stores. You know, I'd get fired from one, go work in another one. Just that kind of went on and on and on. And the drinking was escalating. And, you know, the thing about it is I always thought because cocaine was a heavier drug that's really what my problem was. I stayed sober, and like I said, CA, I had a great sponsor in CA. He had taken me through the steps. I was starting to sponsor other guys. And then I get a call to play in Buckhead, a place called Rupert's in Buckhead. And so, let's see. Party my ass off or say something. It's just, you know, I'd let it get attractive again. And went back out for another year and a half or so, and then came back in to AA for about a year after that, and then it took me 10 years to get back. And that was a whole lot of partying in between. I remember when I went back out one time I knew a guy, his last name was actually LeCoq, believe it or not. I hope nobody knows who that is, but I met him, and he'd gone out, and I'd gone out. And I ran into him somewhere, and he goes, "Yeah, I'm not going to meetings anymore, but I'm still practicing those principles." And then about a month later, I saw him on TV. He was being arrested for running guns, and they put him away. So, you know, it's just insane. You know, just what, you know, what we do as alcoholics is just insane. You know, so it taken me, you know, a few times. I mean, our book talks about that. It says, you know, 75% of the people that come in and really try, not just 75% of people who come in, but 75% of people who come in and really try, which in my mind means getting a sponsor and working the steps, 75% of those people will recover. I think those numbers are probably still true today. You know, people just come in and do what's suggested here. I was part of the ones that they talked about. Those who didn't would come back after a period of time, and then they'd get it, you know, and stuff. And so, you know, for me, it's like I look at my sobriety as is on lease from God. If I don't live up to the terms of my lease agreement, my sobriety could be taken away. Because I've had that happen before. I mean, you know, you know, sometimes here, I'm sure other people do, you know, AA is for people who want it, not for people who need it. And I knew I needed it for quite a long time, and I never stayed around long enough to really find out what it's like to want AA. You know, for me, that took a while. And I remember I was in, when I first had some sobriety in CA, I was getting to the point I was sponsoring guys. And part of the reason I used to go out was, well, these guys won't do what I'm telling them to do. You know, and it's true, unfortunately, a lot of times, you know, there's a high percentage, unfortunately, of people that come in and just don't do what's suggested. And to me, I heard a guy telling his story once and said, introduced himself, of course, as a real alcoholic. And he said, what I mean by a real alcoholic is someone that has to do the 12 steps to stay sober. And, because I mean, I've known other people that I've known in the rooms and stuff, and they'll come in and get sober for a while, and then they'll end up in the church and getting involved in other things and stuff, you know. So, to me, that's a different kind of alcoholic than me. This stuff is just my opinion. You know, some may agree or may not, but today I know what I need to do to stay sober. You know, unfortunately, that's turned into a want. Because as long as I stay in this, you know, I still keep getting the promises and I've been through some difficult times in sobriety, I can tell you that. When I came in, you know, I don't really even know that I came in for myself. You know, people say you can't get sober for somebody else. I'm calling BS on that. I mean, ultimately, when things fall apart, it's a slippery slope. So I met in my 30s, I started hanging out at a place called Cafe 290 in Sandy Springs. And then I was there 6 nights a week. You know, the guy who owned the place was a friend of mine, or is a friend of mine. They let us stay there until 7 in the morning. And so my thinking was, is like, you know what, the cops aren't looking for DUIs at 7:30 in the morning. It just made sense to me. I mean, I'm playing at night. I wouldn't have to get up till 4 o'clock in the afternoon. You know, I go play my gig, get off at 12, and then party till 7 o'clock in the morning. I did that from my 30s on up to when I got sober, 46, I guess. I mean, 5 nights a week. And I had one point where my mother worked at a chiropractic school here, and I used to get adjusted for about $3, and unfortunately, one of the students ruptured a disc in my back. Put me in a commission for 8-9 months, and you know what? The people I'm hanging out with, not one called. These are people I'm hanging out with every night of the week, you know, and nobody called. And so, of course, once I got healed up, it was kind of back. It took me 9 months just about to get back on my feet. My landlord let me slide on rent for 4 years, I think. I mean, some of the stuff that happened to us, I believed in God when I got here because of some of the stuff that I got away with. I really didn't, but I mean, my life was crazy that I, you know, only have one DUI. I was drunk on the road every night. I mean, not just drunk, but high, you know. And so I don't know how that happened. But I feel like, you know, something was out there protecting me during those times. So that wasn't too much of a stretch for me when they started, you know, a power greater than yourselves, you know, that kind of thing. So, but it was just, it's just a crazy lifestyle. So I went into Cafe 290 and saw this girl bouncing around in there like a pinball machine. And so, again, this ended up a date that never ended. At the end of the night, they're kicking us out, and she's coming home with me. I'm not going to get graphic with any of this stuff, so don't worry about it. But if somebody had told me that I was going to end up being my wife that night, I was going to be like, you've got to be kidding. So we were together for 12 years. You know, I was I had decided when we were dating that either I needed to get rid of her or I needed to get sober again. It was funny. It wasn't funny. She had a son that was special needs. He has Asperger's. So we go out to eat, and of course we're ordering drinks, and he just yells out, "She's not supposed to be drinking." Because she'd been arrested 18 times. There's a few people here that know who I'm talking about, and I'm not going to use names or anything else, you know, so out of respect, but that was a crazy, I mean, this is just another insane relationship I got into. And so the first 6 months together, we were together, she was in jail. So I'm in AA, looking for a sponsor, telling them I'm playing music in a bar, my girlfriend's in jail, and I need somebody to sponsor. There weren't a whole lot of takers. There were a few people that stepped up to the plate, you know, but just insane. And so we stayed together. She finally got out of jail and came back home. She started doing her son's medication as soon as she got out of jail. It's like, you know what? Either you get a sponsor, get sober, or get out. And she did. She went and got a sponsor. She got sober. She sobered up for a good long while. She did a good job with it. And her family is just one of these ones with this pill mentality is what I call it. They have pills everywhere. She was a pill addict. And it was just constant drama, just constant drama. I went to Al-Anon to try to stay out of her business, and it was just really hard to do. And of course we finally got married, and eventually that whole thing fell apart. And it was strange because I remember at about 10 years, we're going through some changes and separation and stuff, and it's like I felt like I was starting over again. Because I really think she was like a higher power to me, you know. I mean, I got married, which I was, you know, I liked being married and stuff. And again, we had some good times and stuff. But once that fell apart and that wasn't there, it's like all of a sudden, man, that was there wasn't much foundation there. So, you know, by the grace of God, I have the thought is like, you know, I've either got to get really back into this program or I'm going to be drunk again. You know, which is what I think probably she wanted. She had relapsed 15 times in 3 years. And my heart went out to her because she tried to get back up on the wagon or whatever you want to call it, and just could not do it. And so we ended up getting divorced. And, you know, that's a tough thing, man. So, like I say, I don't know that I completely got sober for myself, but what I am thankful for is that by the grace of God, I've been able to stay around here long enough to want this and to want to keep coming back. And, you know, I mean, our book talks about we trudge the road to a happy destiny, and it's a trudge. I believe the meaning of trudges means walking with purpose, you know, and there's a lot of times, I mean, you know, the efforts get a lot of us, you know, just the effort. And I just know it was kind of weird to me. It was 5 years sober before I realized I had diabetes. And man, I was drinking these sugary grandma drinks, Grand Marnier stuff, like it was water, not knowing, you know. So I finally got health insurance because my wife at that time, my ex-wife at the time, was working for Kroger. And so I finally was able to get a colonoscopy, and I won't get too gross about this. But so they knock you out, and I wake up in the recovery room. Now, I'd have 5 years sober at this time. And I wake up, and the doctor's standing right there, and his first question to me goes, "Do you drink a lot?" I said, "No, I've been sober 5 years, thank you very much." He said, "Well, we couldn't keep you knocked out." And that's some heavy stuff they use. Right, Lisa? Although you're a dentist, but I mean, I know you know medical stuff, but that's some pretty heavy-duty stuff. So, you know, that gives pause to me is like, you know, people talk about this. I use the word illness. I don't use the word disease. I think there are too many diseases and too many pills to go with them out there today. But Bill Wilson called it a spiritual illness. So, and I forgot where I was going with that. I've got a senior moment. Colonoscopy, yeah. Thank you. So the illness progresses. Even though I have not been using it, I have 5 years sober, he's asking me that kind of question. It's like, how can that be? And that's a really, really heavy drug. Now, I could drink a lot. I mean, I was, at the end there, I was probably somewhere in the 25 to 30 drinks a night range, something like that. This is funny because what I heard about 6 months ago is you can't really impress alcoholics. You know, that sounds like a lot. But, you know, the thing is, I have to realize I'm not the worst anything and not the best anything. You know, I mean, I was going to give the disclaimer when I first started. I'm a musician, so hang on. But, you know, I've heard guys that are used car salesmen that have worse stories than I did. Wouldn't have to be a musician. You know, being an alcoholic, man, it just takes on some crazy dimensions. You know, so I guess that's about all I got. I mean, today, I'm coming up on 17 years sober. I started drinking when I was 15, so, you know, if there's any truth to 10 miles in and 10 miles out of the woods, maybe I'm 3/4 out, I don't know. But I'm just thankful to AA, the people, you all, and by the grace of God, I'm still sober today.
Thank you, George. I needed that.
Well, my head was in tomorrow, and my feet followed history. I had an insane notion I could hoodoo everything around me. No. 'Cause too much of everything ain't enough for nothing to me. I got a nudge from the judge, Lord, it put me in recovery. But